What do you picture when you think of invisibility? Maybe it's Harry and his invisibility cloak, or Violet from The Incredibles.
For season 5 of Modcast, we'll be stepping beyond the world of fiction and into the world of fact.
I'm Malvika.
And I'm Sam. Join us as we go full incognito to look into invisibility in all its shapes and forms.
Welcome to Planet Earth, a world that is full of invisible people, processes, places, and things.
But before we look further, we must ask, what does invisibility look like in this world?
A lot of technologists in Silicon Valley were saying things like, no one expects a right to privacy anymore.
Sam, you remember Dr. Owen Churches, yeah?
The Dr. Owen Churches? The data statistician at the South Australian Health and Medical Research Institute?
Exactly, from episode 2. And he might be right. As we become more digitally connected, the right to privacy is becoming more and more skewed. And that brings us to today's episode, privacy, and more specifically, data privacy online. Now, what is data privacy? It's kinda hard to define, but Dr. Kirsten Wahlstrom, a lecturer and research academic in computer science at the University of South Australia, says that its definition varies depending on whose data it is and their circumstances.
But ultimately, it all comes down to who holds what data, what are they doing with it, and did the person described in the data give informed consent to the way that data is being used.
Now, giving up our data isn't necessarily a bad thing. Think about the time you selected the checkbox to have your password remembered, or even being alerted of a special sale at your favourite store. You gave up your data privacy for convenience, and that's all because of cookies.
Cookies? As in chocolate chip?
Yeah, nah. We're talking about a virtual kind of cookies, and if you've never heard of cookies, I'm sure you've definitely seen it. They're often placed at the bottom of a website, and they'll ask you whether you accept cookies or not.
Oh, but here in Australia, websites don't need your explicit consent to use cookies, right? But in places like the EU, they do?
That's right. And if this sounds foreign to you, Dr. Wahlstrom says that you can think of cookies like little crumbs of data left on your computer when you browse the internet.
So you might visit a website and the website leaves a cookie on your computer. And you might think, what's the point of that? Well, it tells the website the last time you visited it, and it builds up the cookie over time. And there are other cookies that collect all of the different clicks that you do on the internet. And so when you visit the website again, for instance, it might be the Google search page, it'll read its cookie and it will find out all the stuff that you've been doing since the last time you visited.
And they can be super useful.
Every time you fill in a form on the internet and it is magically filled in with all of your information already, that's because it got read out of a cookie. And so it can be handy if you don't like doing all that typing.
For those living with a disability, sharing their data has allowed some to lead a greater quality of life through brain-computer interfaces. Simply put, a brain-computer interface is a technology that allows a person to control a device in the real world using their mind.
It works by collecting their neural activity, and then it maps the neural activity to a particular outcome in the real world.
This is one of the research areas Dr. Wahlstrom looked into. She said that for a person living with a disability who is wheelchair bound, it would allow them to move as they think.
So, for example, the person using the wheelchair might imagine going forward, and the brain computer interface picks up on that signal and drives the wheelchair forward. Or they might imagine turning to the left. The brain-computer interface picks up on that neural signal and drives the wheelchair to the left, and so on.
Honestly, this seems all too good to be true. Is there a catch?
Yeah, there kind of is. It's a trade-off between privacy and convenience.
For instance, a person using a wheelchair gets great advantage from sharing their intimate neural data with the device, because they have much greater autonomy, the loss in privacy is worth the gain in autonomy.
Dr. Wahlstrom says that in order to have a fair trade-off, it all boils down to consent.
I think it comes down to the license agreements and any secondary uses that the data gets put to. For example, if I go back to that situation of a disabled person using a wheelchair, then if that brain-computer interface isn't on the internet and it's a closed system, what we might call air-gapped, then although their neural data is being shared with that device, it's not being shared any further. And so they may still have a fairly high level of privacy. On the other hand, if the company providing the device likes to collect up all of that neural data because it might be a useful data asset one day, then we come into a data privacy grey area where we have no regulation and we're not sure if that's acceptable to the user or whether the corporation is being ethical or not.
Now, there's no surefire way to stop your data being collected, unless, of course, you're willing to go completely off-grid. But there are ways you can better manage your privacy online.
Dr. Anisha Fernando is a data ethics researcher at the University of South Australia. She says it's a matter of asking yourself questions like,
when you're online, you've got to think, who am I having this conversation with? Is it just my email account? Is there anyone else listening in? Do they need to know? What do they need to know? How much?
She understands that we're not trained to think like that. But if you're wanting to have more control over your privacy online, this is how we need to be thinking.
That's what happens when our data flows. We're having conversations with other people, with agents, with bots, with systems, and we need to figure out how to better relate to it. Coming out of my PhD, I found that a lot of people, and this is then the research, you know, we've got different privacy tools, but people don't seem to use it, or there's this lot of, you know, I'm sort of generalizing here, but there's a need for privacy. People say they want privacy, but they don't actually do anything about it.
And from her standpoint, letting Google save your password, unfortunately, isn't good security.
It's a bit like if you would you lock your door at night? Would you leave it half, you know?
She says that if you're serious about privacy, it's a matter of going through the settings function on all the different software you have.
People typically might have an email account, one or more. You might be using one or more messaging apps, photo sharing apps, and things like that. So I think looking at all of those and then maybe going to the settings thinking, you know, do you really need it tracking your location every time you take a photo? And having that, you know, crowd searched and things like that. Are you backing up your data?
And if you've hauled through all your applications and still aren't satisfied with the privacy controls, there are services out there that are giving privacy back to its users.
Like internet browser Mozilla Firefox.
They've been doing a lot of great work with making a more privacy-sensitive browser. So Firefox, I think there's Firefox Focus. So they build so that the browser itself limits cookies that are not tracking you. The do not track setting is set to on by default.
And if you're wanting to go full-blown incognito, there's the search engine DuckDuckGo. It allows users to have complete anonymity each time they browse. As for email and messaging, there's ProtonMail and Signal, both of which provide end-to-end encryption, which means that only those sending and receiving the message or email can see it.
Okay, so there's services out there we can use to better control our privacy, but surely that doesn't mean it's all well and good.
Yeah, you're right. Dr. Wallstrom says that she also still has reservations surrounding data privacy.
I still have some reservations in broad terms because I don't know how well everybody is informed about their data privacy. I'm still not convinced that everybody knows the amount of data that's being collected about them. But if we reach that point, then I will be happy with the equilibrium. I think we will have reached a place where people are knowingly consenting to having their data collected. If we can get to that point, I'll be satisfied. For the time being, I'm still a little bit troubled, especially when I see, for instance, data being shared about very young children on the internet when they can't possibly be consenting yet. Infants and people like that, like very young people, it troubles me when their parents share their information online without the child being able to consent.
But there is hope, and one way to make data privacy less of this grey beast is through education.
You know, a lot of us know that, you know, in the research has been studied that humans can't read through a lot of the terms and conditions, and yet that's the basic tool that we have to say we consent to our data being shared. I think it's just a lot of that is educative, you know, giving people the skills, making it less confusing, giving them an opportunity to kind of understand and then develop and build and empower themselves with some practices that can then enable them to make those decisions for themselves, because that would then make a stronger community.
One way that Dr. Fernando is empowering people to make better decisions online and in the real world is through a card game she developed.
What? Do you mean blackjack?
Nah, not blackjack. The game needs at least two players and works like this. One person picks up a card and it will ask you questions along the lines of trustworthiness of your opponent. It then encourages both of you to assess not only the trustworthiness of both of you in real life, but in an online setting as well.
How do you know your online interaction is trustworthy? So you kind of take the real life interaction, sort of think about how trust works in the online sphere, and then think about, okay, are there instances where you felt like, I didn't know what was happening. I'm not sure whether I can trust that. And we're seeing a lot of scams these days with the phones. So how do you know that's a real text? How do you know it's a scam? And issues like that. So, and getting people to sort of then have that conversation and then designing their own approach. So getting them to think, okay, what am I going to do about it actually? And that's the takeaway. So it's not just giving people information, but making it actionable to them, saying, okay, what practices am I going to do the next time I'm online?
As for the future of data privacy, Dr. Wahlstrom says she's confident that more and more people will become aware of the data that is shared about them, which will allow them to make more informed decisions.
I recently was told an anecdote about somebody who's in high school, and he had given up all of his social media and gaming and had stopped taking photos on his phone. He's got an SLR camera now, and he is disengaged from digital technologies completely because he was resentful about the data privacy intrusions in his life. On the other hand, you know, some people really don't mind at all.
Whether you don't mind being tracked online or if you're in the same boat as this high schooler.
We hope this episode has provided you a better understanding of data privacy and some practical ways to better manage your data online.
And that you've enjoyed listening to Season 5 of Modcast.
And sadly, this is the last episode from the two of us.
We hope to see you in the next season of Modcast or at Mod itself, unless, of course, you're camouflaged in a bush.
Or if you've turned off your cookies. That's all from us.
Goodbye.
This was the fourth and final episode in Modcast Season 5 Invisibility. This episode was produced by Melvika Hemanth and senior produced by Caitlin Ellen Moore from Radio Adelaide. Thanks to Dr. Owen Churches, Dr. Kristen Wahlstrom, and Dr. Anisha Fernando for their insights in this episode. And thanks also to Lisa Bailey, Lisa Burns, and Natalie Kafora for additional series support and resources. Modcast Series 5 Invisibility is presented by Mod at the University of South Australia and is linked to an exhibition, which you can find at mod.org.au or in person.